Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to the announcer's booth with the best damn announce team, period. I'm Greg Hunter, and here's your host, John the Body Johnson.
Well, hello again, everyone. Yes, indeed, I am John the Body Johnson, and we are outside again. You can tell because Greg Hunter's allergies have him choked up a little bit, or maybe it's something else. I don't know, but what's going on, Greg?
Not a whole lot. Hoping this truck behind us moves soon.
Yeah, in case you missed last week, we're back. Obviously, yes. This is the second week in a row. But we're having to do this on our lunch breaks while we're here at work because our schedules and our hectic, busy lives don't allow us to Skype much. But no, we're here with the Announcer's Booth podcast, and we're going to do our continuation of our SummerSlam discussion from last week, kind of the fallout. We figured that we could fit the main event into much of the hour.
Probably.
And also it gave us a chance to watch Raw, watch SmackDown.
Gave you a chance too.
Yeah, I didn't really watch. I mean, I watched Raw. Didn't get a chance to watch much of SmackDown. But it gave us a chance to, you know, follow up and see where they were going and kind of gauge our, you know, responses, which, you know, whatever. But before we get into that, before we get into some of the other things going on, sad news in the world of professional wrestling this past Sunday. Longtime manager and wrestler Mr. Fuji passes away at the age of 82. I didn't realize how, well, I guess relatively close he was to us. He was in Clarksville, Tennessee.
Yes, I think at one point he was like a movie theater manager or something. I think was one of his more recent jobs.
Yeah, I don't know if he was a movie theater manager or just worked in the movie theater because he was in his 70s. It was when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, but yeah, the Mr. Fuji, multiple-time WWF Tag Team Champion, managed WWF Tag Team Champion Demolition, passes away. Guy had a great life, man. I pulled up some stuff on him here, just taking a look at some of his accomplishments in wrestling, things I didn't know. I didn't realize, you know, all the places that he had gone, the titles he won, the Mid-Atlantic Tag Team titles. He was a Mid-Pacific Hawaiian Tag Team Champion, British Commonwealth Heavyweight Champion, a New Zealand version once, held the United States Heavyweight Championship, the San Francisco version. So, guy was a well-decorated star. But one of the things that caught my eye on here, and I, you know, you'd never really want to disparage the dead, and you don't want to bring up the bad things. He had an 11-year run as the Wrestling Observer Newsletter's worst manager of the year from 1984 to 1995.
I mean, to give an indication here of how well-traveled Fuji really was, he was an AWA Southern Tag Champ in Memphis. He was a Georgia Tag Champ with Georgia Championship Wrestling. He was with Crockett in Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. I think San Francisco would have been, what, Royshire?
I believe so, yeah.
So he was in San Francisco. He worked in the Pacific Northwest for Don Owens. He worked for Carlos Colon and company down in Puerto Rico with WWC. So he, and of course the WWE. So, I mean, incredibly well-traveled.
Him with Jim Barnett in Australia in WCW.
Yep, the original WCW, yes. The original World Championship Wrestling. So, yeah, incredibly well-traveled, but I made this remark earlier today before we started recording. Fuji, I think, and the more I think about it, the more I suspect this is indicative of just managers in the WWF in his era. They really didn't have dedicated managers. And I think this is something we could turn into a discussion later. If you stop and think about it, you had Arnie Scolland, who had been a wrestler. You had Fred Blassie, who had been a wrestler. You had Lou Albano, who was over in that territory, half of the Sicilians. You had Fuji from Fuji and Saito, Fuji and Tanaka, you know, several different Asian tag teams playing off the stereotypical Japanese gimmick. And as you go down the road, that's the tendency. Before Bobby Heenan, the only dedicated manager you had there was the Grand Wizard.
Right.
Fuji, I think for a while, and even what was it, Luscious Johnny Valiant.
He was a former tag team champion.
A lot of these guys were. A lot of these guys were over talent in the WWF. And I really think this was just a case in a lot of their cases, it wasn't so much, hey, let's this guy is such an amazing mouthpiece, let's put him in this spot. I think it was more of, you know, this guy's been a loyal hand, let's keep him around. Arne Skaaland's promos never set the world on fire.
Right.
Lou Albano's promos until The Ultimate Warrior came along were the most unintelligible in the business. Freddie Blassie cut a good promo, but the whole presence of Fred Blassie was more. So, you know, it's... And Fuji, the gag I made this morning was Fuji was the guy that when they finally gave him the top heel in the company, they had to give the mouthpiece a mouthpiece. Demolition could talk. They had right. Bill Eadie. I mean, Bill Eadie and, for the love of God, I don't remember the other dude's name.
Barry Darso,
yes.
Are you kidding me?
Well, there were two of them.
That's true. Randy Cooley was the other one.
Yeah. Thank God Barry Darso come along.
Yes.
So so you had, or as Ernie Lowe would say, Fat Darso. So, I mean, you had Bill Eadie and you had Barry Darso, both of whom could talk. So Fuji didn't need to.
But, you know, it was kind of like the dynamic with them, you know, kind of, and listen to what I'm going to say because it's kind of funny that we mentioned this. Mm-hmm. The dynamic with them was almost like the Road Warriors dynamic. They didn't need Paul Ellering to talk for them. Paul Ellering tied it in together because Hawk and Animal both could talk. But the only thing is, you had Demolition who both could talk.
Are you really fixing to compare Fuji to Paul Ellering?
No. What I'm saying is, listen to what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Paul Ellering could talk.
Uh-huh.
Fuji could just laugh and kind of give that maniacal, typical heel Japanese, like, ha ha ha, yes, ha ha ha.
I think Fuji with Demolition, I don't agree with that at all. I think Fuji with Demolition was there to make them heels. And I think that's realistically the only reason he was there. Because Fuji was a heel. Fuji was a credible heel. And I think he was there to make them heels because Demolition comes along as heels around the same time the Road Warriors are babyfaces. The Road Warriors are obviously what they copied with Demolition.
Right.
I mean, that was the template.
Yeah.
So I think it was more of a case of we want the Road Warriors. We can't have the Road Warriors. Let's make our Road Warriors, but we want them to be bad guys.
But
and
you
so
know,
they put Fuji with them. And I disagree. I actually think the Road Warriors needed Paul Ellering.
Really?
Yes.
They got over without him in the WWF?
They got over without him in the WWF because they were already over. The WWF got a proven commodity when they got the Road Warriors. They already had the cachet. They were already over. And eventually, the WWF did bring Paul Ellering in for them.
Yeah, that was probably one of the worst things they ever did, though, because they brought in the dummy, too.
Yeah, well, that's because they always wanted to gimmick shit up. And then when they repackaged the Road Warriors, what'd they do? They again gave them a manager, this case Tammy Sitch, still another very credible talker.
Right.
So, you know, that which is not to disparage the promo capabilities of either Hawk or Animal. The Road Warriors could cut a hell of a promo. But where the Road Warriors were nasty and mean and brutal and all of this, Paul Ellering brought it together is not a bad way to phrase it. I just don't think the comparison is right between them and Demolition. Paul Ellering took what could have been simply a couple of badass bikers and turned them either into sinister villains,
right,
or turned them into the anti-hero.
Right.
So one or the other.
Yeah.
Fuji's presence, though, I mean, yeah, he was the 11-time worst manager of the year, according to the Wrestling Observer newsletter. But he was...
Do you think they'll rename the award?
The Fuji Memorial worst Manager of the Year award?
I wonder if they even still give that away. There's not really many managers nowadays.
No, but there are still enough bad ones.
that's true.
So, I mean, we've worked with a few. But I think Fuji's presence... was crucial. I think he was an over-the-top character in an era where the WWE needed over-the-top characters. I can't think of a talent that he was with long-term that I thought was a useless pairing. And him with Yokozuna, I think, was his best run as a manager because it was the run that made the most sense for Fuji. Because here is Fuji, who is the manager and, for want of a better term, interpreter for the Samoan WWE champion that we're going to pass off as Japanese.
Right.
But Fuji's promos were so unbefitting of what they ultimately wanted that they had to bring Jim Cornette in to be the mouthpiece. So Cornette, in essence, managed the manager.
Been there, done that.
Yes. So, I mean, Jim Cornette was the mouthpiece where Fuji was the physicality when physicality was called for. Because, now that damn tennis racket didn't come into play as near as much as the salt did.
Right, right.
So they let Fuji be the sneaky heel.
Yeah.
And they let Cornette talk.
Yeah. And like I said, you know, Fuji also offered up some real memorable moments, you know, because, you know, like me, my thing is
Fuji Vice.
Yes, it's the haha side. You know, Fuji Vice, as horrible as it was still very, very funny. Still very entertaining. One of the most memorable things I think Fuji ever done was the WrestleMania 4 5K run where he ran the marathon, supposedly ran the marathon. He had his tuxedo on still, and he cheated to win the marathon, which I thought was the greatest thing ever. I mean, it's hilarious stuff. And, you know, like I said, Fuji's going to be missed, man. You know, he was somebody who, he went away in the late 90s, mid-90s, went away in the mid-90s, rode off into the sunset, no more Mr. Fuji, was gone long enough that, you know, when he came in for his Hall of Fame induction, it was very, very memorable. It actually meant something. You know, he was frail. You know, he was in a wheelchair and, you know, he was getting older, but it was really cool to see them celebrate his life the way they did and celebrate, you know, why he was still alive. But I didn't know this. He actually sued the makers of WCW versus NWO World Tour over one of the playable characters in there, Master Fuji, claiming that it was too close of a likeness to his. In fact, we have our notes here. Yeah, he left wrestling. He retired to Knoxville in 1997. He sued the makers of the video game WCW versus NWO World Tour, claiming that the character Master Fuji was based on him, though the basis of this character was actually Japanese wrestler Yoshiaki Fujiwara, which is no relation. It was actually close enough to Mr. Fuji that the lawsuit was settled in Mr. Fuji's favor.
For the record, Yoshiaki Fujiwara would be, if I'm not mistaken, the innovator of the Fujiwara armbar. So,
well, thank you there, Mike Tenay.
Well, there you go. that was my role when we were actually, you know, wrestling announcers.
Yes, and actually, you know, he was training wrestlers until 2001.
What I find amazing here, because I didn't realize, he was trained by Nick Bockwinkle.
Yes. I've seen that earlier, too. So a lot of things about, you know, Fuji that, you know, like, and here's the thing. I'm not going to lie. I have never sought out any information on Mr. Fuji until he passed away, which is really sad because, you know, I was never really a fan of his entire body of work. Like I said, he had some memorable moments. I know that they were planning a feud between Bobby Heenan and Mr. Fuji at one time that was playing out on the MSG network. I remember seeing some of that when I was younger because, you know, Heenan was saying some disparaging things and, you know, there was little hints, but it never, you know, transpired, never went out, never did anything. But, you know, but very interesting guy.
Think about this for a second. If I read off this list is ridiculous. This is the list of wrestlers he managed. George Steele, Don Morocco, Bob Orton Jr., the Moondogs, Killer Khan, Jim Neidhart, Sika of the Samoans, Kimala, Demolition, the Powers of Pain, the Berserker, everybody screws up once, the Orient Express, Crush, Yokozuna, Owen Hart, Davey Boy Smith, and Jeff Jarrett.
Yeah.
I don't remember him managing Jeff Jarrett.
It was probably just a very brief run. But, you know, also, but take a look at who he was managed by at one point.
And he was managed by Lou Albano, Fred Blassie, and the Grand Wizard, which if the WWF was ever going to put together a Mount Rushmore of managers, it's probably them. So, along with Heenan.
Of course, you know, I'm going to put Heenan on there. Heenan goes on any Mount Rushmore. But, you know, so, I mean, big loss to the world of professional wrestling, I guess you could say. I mean, you know, it's one of those moments, you know, and like I said, it's not, I mean, okay, let me say it like this, and I don't mean, like I said, not to be disparaging or anything. His influence currently in wrestling is very hard to find. I mean, there are some sneaky heels, there are some of that, you know, may borrow, but I mean, you know, as far as in the here and now, a lot of people don't say, well, you know, I borrowed from Mr. Fuji, or I did this from Mr. Fuji, right, or this and the other. I mean, the thing is that link from wrestling's future and present to its past, you know, we've lost one of those links down. The chain is getting a little smaller.
Yeah, I mean, nobody, Shinsuke Nakamura is not going to start throwing salt in people's eyes this week on NXT. But
he should.
But at the same time, no, absolutely. And, you know, but this is one of those passings in wrestling that you don't look at and go, this was a tragedy. Fuji lived a long, full life.
Which is unusual in our business.
Which is very unusual in the wrestling business, especially now.
Yeah.
So, I think, of course, his family will mourn, they will grieve. But as fans, I think it's, you know, take the time to celebrate the life of a guy who was a contributor to the greatest sport in the world, as Ric Flair often would say, for, you know, literally decades. I mean, I believe he walked away somewhere in the early, like late 90s, early 2000s would have been the end of his run. He started in 65.
Yeah.
So at least 4 decades.
Yeah. Well, you know, and here's another thing too, and this will be the last thing we touch on Fuji. I was looking over some of the accomplishments here.
The Master River.
He was, well, yeah, he was that too. But he was also ranked number 445 out of 500 of the best single wrestlers of the PWI years back in 2003. Now, that covers from 1979 when PWI first came out to 2003. So you think about how many guys entered the square circle, you know, entered the square circle during that time. Think about how many top wrestlers are out there, and to be, you know, in the top 500 of those guys and to be number 445, yeah, that's an amazing accomplishment. It just shows exactly really what he could do in the ring.
It really is. It really is absolutely amazing.
So, one thing I also wanted to touch on real quick before we get into the SummerSlam main event, I want to see, you know, if you have a take. I don't know, you know, if you've been paying attention or not, but the whole Colin Kaepernick controversy out in San Francisco. Do you know who Colin Kaepernick is?
Oh, is this the whole thing where he wouldn't stand for the national anthem?
Yeah, Colin Kaepernick not standing for the national anthem. Now, here, I want to say one thing. And I know this is going to get me a ton of flack, although I've already had people, I posted this on Facebook and I had people like it. It was a comment that I made. Here's the thing. I fully 100% support Colin Kaepernick's decision not to stand for the national anthem. I don't agree with it. I think it's disrespectful. It's not something that I would do. But at the same time, I support his decision. And here's why. Him sitting for the national anthem actually lends more credence to the importance of that flag than if he had stand. Because here's the thing. In the United States of America, you are free to have an opinion. You are free to take a stand, or in his case, make a sit. You are free to do the things that you feel you have to do when you feel that there's an injustice. It's what makes America great. You know, and here's another reason why it makes America great. If he pulled this shit in a communist country, if he tried this in one of these Middle Eastern countries that are dictatorships, or, you know, in Nazi Germany, or in Russia, or somewhere like that, he would be facing a ton of shit right now, possibly even death. He would be executed for not showing homage to his country.
There have been historically, and may still be around the world, certain nations where the act that he took would be considered treason.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, America was built on the concept of freedoms. You have the freedom to make such a choice. And I have the freedom to tell you you're a disrespectful prick for doing it.
Exactly.
It's the words of the philosopher Voltaire. I do not agree with a word you say, but I will defend to my death your right to say it.
Right.
that sort of thing.
Yeah, so, you know, but my thing is this, and it's the truth. You know, I don't like the fact that he did it. You know, you and I have friends who have been in the military, who fought for this country. You know, part of his, his reasoning behind this is through a lot of the things that have been going on between, you know, the police officers and the African-American community as of late, you know. And I get that. Trust me. I 100% get that. But here's the thing. If you are going to use your fame to make a stand in a positive sense. You know, sitting for the national anthem, it's not doing anything. You know, I mean, if that's how you feel you have to do it, do it. And, you know, you can sit there and say, I have the right to do this, but you also need to know. And it's like, you know, I'm a big proponent of the freedom of speech, and you know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm very much First Amendment. You know, I believe that you should be able to say what you want to say when you want to say it, and you do have that right. But you also need to understand that you've got to live with the consequences of your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the NFL is a multi-billion dollar industry. The San Francisco 49ers are a $1 billion, you know, franchise in that industry.
Mm-hmm.
They have to answer to people who buy tickets. They have to answer to the people who pay the TV revenues. They have a lot of people they have to answer to.
Absolutely.
And here's the thing. Levi Stadium seats a lot of people to come in to see football games. And I guarantee you, out of those season ticket holders, there are a lot of police officers who are season ticket holders. There are also a lot of proud members of the military that are season ticket holders, that this may affect their decision to go to games, to pay for season tickets, to buy San Francisco 49er merchandise. You have to be careful with the things you do and how you choose them. And Colin Kaepernick just backed himself into a corner. But I will say that to say this. I honestly don't believe he has that stance. I really don't. Here's the thing. Colin Kaepernick is just trying to make himself relevant again. He had a couple of hot years in San Francisco. He's waned a little bit. His production's not up to where it should be. You know, he's kind of a forgotten guy. He's somebody that, you know, you don't talk about Colin Kaepernick. But now here we are talking about Colin Kaepernick. He just wanted to make himself trend a little bit. He wanted to put his name out there. So I question if he actually has this belief or not. That's just me. So that's enough about Colin Kaepernick. And by the way, hashtag fuck Kaepernick.
Yeah, we've put this asshole over long enough on this show.
So, but and here's the thing also. If you disagree with what I'm saying, I completely 100% respect your right to disagree. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not saying I'm wrong. All I'm saying is you cannot in this country have the belief that you should have one right and then deny somebody else their right to do something else. That's all I'm going to say. But I guess we're going to get to the main event portion of this show here. And speaking of main events, that's exactly what it was. Revisiting SummerSlam.
The main event of SummerSlam 2016, in my humble opinion, one of the worst SummerSlam main events of all time. Randy Orton versus Brock Lesnar. A match with nothing whatsoever at stake.
Hold on. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Now, are you saying the worst or one of the worst?
One of the worst.
Okay.
I off the top of my head, and I know that there have been worse than even what I'm going to say, the worst one off the top of my head is Undertaker. Is Undertaker versus Brian Lee.
You know, so, I would go so far as to
I
say...
Although I won $50 off that.
Nice.
Yeah, I bet a guy the Undertaker would win.
Nice. And somebody actually was dumb enough to take that bet?
Yes.
Very good. you know, here's the thing, though. Maybe Hogan Warrior against Slaughter and Sheik and Adnan would...
Had heat.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, it had heat, but, I mean, it wasn't that good of a match. Actually, you know what? If you really look at those first
I'm about to pull up SummerSlam here on my phone.
Okay.
And we're going to see if we can look at the SummerSlam main events.
First 4 years of SummerSlam. Hogan and Savage against DiBiase and Andre.
Which was good.
Okay.
I'm not going to say that one was bad.
Now, what about Hogan and Beefcake against Savage and Zeus?
If you take Zeus out of the equation. okay, so real quick rundown. Going from 88. Mega Powers Megabucks was a good little match.
Yeah.
Good story. Got to see Elizabeth's tush. Which is the only thing anyone remembers the match. Hogan, Beefcake versus Savage and Zeus. Not great. Warrior versus Rude in a cage for the world title, which is the first time the world title was defended at SummerSlam. I actually think that one deserves more credit than it gets. Because I saw that. That was actually the first pay-per-view I ever saw.
Really?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, I had never actually seen a pay-per-view as it happened.
Okay, now hold on. But wait a minute now. You were born in 81?
Uh-huh.
So 9 years goes by. Well, you're nine. Okay.
Yeah,
so
I'm 9 years old.
Is that now? Hold on. Mm-hmm. Let's play devil's advocate here for just a second. Let's kind of delve, because we got to get into the main event.
Yes.
Now, is that the first one you remember watching?
No,
or is that legit the first one?
No, that is the first pay-per-view that was ever bought and watched in my house. Well, not even in my house. It was my sister's house at the time, my half-sister.
I'm going to share something. You know what my first pay-per-view was? Starrcade 87.
Nice.
Yeah. Actually, no. I take that back. I'm wrong. No, I'm right. Starrcade 87 from Chicago. That was the very first pay-per-view bought in my house. Now, I say that to say this. I did go see WrestleMania 2 and WrestleMania 3 in closed circuit. I was very young, but I went there, so...
You got Hogan Warrior versus Slaughter, Mustafa, Iron Sheik, and Adnan, which, again, wasn't terrible. Bret Hart and Bulldog for the IC title.
Was good.
Yep. Yokozuna Luger for the world title.
Horrible.
Taker. Yokozuna Luger, again, had a story and had some heat behind it. Diesel versus King Mabel for the World Heavyweight Championship. There's ass.
Yeah.
Michaels and Vader, which was not good and should have been much better, but Shawn Michaels didn't want to work with Vader, really.
He was scared, I remember, right?
Yeah, Taker Bret Hart, Austin Taker, Austin Mankind Triple H, Rock Kurt Triple H, Booker T versus The Rock for the WCW World title.
Wow.
Which is the only time the WCW title main evented a WWF pay-per-view that I'm aware of on its own. Brock Rock. Let's see here. Triple H, Jericho, Nash, Michaels, Orton, Goldberg in the Elimination Chamber.
Is that the one where... Is that the Elimination Chamber? Or is that the match where Michaels had, like, the real short hair and, like, the dookie brown pants?
I think.
Yeah.
I think. Benoit versus Orton, which is where Orton wins the title.
Yep.
And
breaks up Evolution.
Yep. Michaels, Hogan. Edge, John Cena. John Cena, Orton. Taker, Edge, Hell in a Cell. World title, Hardy versus Punk, TLC. Which was apparently advertised as a... So that's the entire damn card. No, this is several WrestleManias in a row. Several SummerSlams in a row at the same building. WWE versus The Nexus. Punk, Cena for the Undisputed title. Lesnar, Triple H. Cena, Daniel Bryan for the WWE title. Cena, Brock for the WWE title. Brock, Undertaker, Brock Orton. Brock's actually main evented the last three.
And he's main evented what? Five, six of them almost?
I think five.
Five?
Yeah.
Because there was Brock Rock.
No, four.
Okay. Brock Rock.
Brock versus The Rock. And then, I guess he did main event four versus Triple H. And then he's main evented the last three in a row.
But he's main evented like four of the last six though, right? There was one
four out of the last five.
Four out of the last five, okay.
And then this one, which was terrible.
So that's the one we want to talk about.
Yeah, it's... Okay, we'll get the elephant out in the room taken care of early. Yes, it was a work. At this point, there's no denying it was a work. We will address a few things. Number one, I didn't care for the build up to it. I thought the build was short. There was nothing at stake. They didn't even really play up the Raw versus SmackDown Pride thing. It was just Orton versus Brock, the match that never happened on pay-per-view. There was nothing at stake. Absolutely nothing. Neither man pride to two people who have the careers these two men have should mean nothing.
Right.
It's not like the winner gets a shot at his brand's title. It's not if Orton wins, he gets a shot at the world title. If Brock wins, he gets a shot at the Universal title. They didn't do that. There was nothing, if Brock wins, Raw gets this. If SmackDown wins, or if Orton wins, SmackDown gets that. None of that. It was a match. It was, I think it was trying to buy a house. Realistically, I think they were just trying to buy a house off of that main event. Because it was two guys... Brock Lesnar, who at this point is a attraction because he's not there often enough to be figured in, versus the guy that is going to be there and be figured in who just came back. I think they were trying to steal a house.
You know, and I can see that. However,
they did, for the record. Yeah. They did steal a house. Yeah.
And you know, I said it last week, and I've said to you over the course of the past week, and, you know, just conversations we've had, not here on the podcast, obviously, but I think there's something bigger in the works. I think that there's something that we're not seeing right now that they've got there, because here's the thing. It's the slow burn. You know, Triple H talked about the slow burn, you know, a couple of years ago, because we talked about it on the podcast when we talked about it. You know, getting to, you know, doing that program. And I really believe, and I want to believe, because, you know, I'm such a fan of the business, and I love wrestling. And, you know, I mean, here's the thing. You can't love wrestling without having a place for your in your heart for the WWE. Because here's the thing. That's the grandest stage.
Yeah.
For this business to thrive, this is what people don't realize. For wrestling to thrive, WWE has to be successful. Because they're on the largest stage.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no WWE, there is nothing else.
Unless somebody comes along that can rival the WWE, unless somebody is David that topples Goliath and then becomes Goliath, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
The WWE toppled Jim Crockett Promotions and the NWA.
Right.
Before the WWE, if the NWA didn't do good, wrestling didn't do good.
Right.
Now, if the WWE doesn't do good, wrestling doesn't do good.
Yeah.
It's like that. You know, no matter where you are in the world, if you're in Japan, if New Japan is sucking back, then everybody is.
Yeah.
If, you know, but for a while it was, if all Japan is doing terrible, everyone does. And
right.
Before that it was, if the JWA does terrible, everyone does. So there's always a lead dog in the pack.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, like, you know, to me, it's like I want so badly for them to succeed and for them to do things. And the thing is, and I heard somebody mention this the other day. I was reading a column. I want to say it may have been on Deadspin or Bleacher Report. It was on one of these online sites that I go to, I frequent, but I just can't remember which one. It shows how prepared.
One of the digital dirt sheets.
Yes. And they made a good point. And, you know, and I know we're supposed to be touching on this main event, but that's kind of what we're doing. I mean,
right.
By the way, in case you haven't fucking seen it, Brock busts Randy Orton open. And the match was stopped TKO.
Yeah, with what was effectively a shoot elbow to the face.
Yeah, which supposedly there is question, did Randy okay that or not? But hey, you know what? Everybody knew going in what this was going to be, so whatever. But anyway, getting back to my point. They had a point in this dirt sheet, in this digital dirt sheet as you call it, that WWE, whether we realize it or not, they are keeping one toe in PG and dipping another foot into something totally different. There's an evolution going on right now in WWE that we're seeing. Yes, they're bringing in some young talent. They're calling it the new era, right?
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things they're doing with this new era talent is they're allowing these guys to go out and do the things that made them famous.
Mm-hmm.
These guys, their promos are not as scripted as they were 5 years ago.
I mean, even if you look at a show like Talking Smack on the network,
which is what I was going to get to,
is effectively bullet pointed shoot promos.
Yeah.
It's here are your bullet points. We're not scripting it. Here's your bullet points. Go out and deliver. And I will argue, and I'm sure we'll come back to it, Ms. Daniel Bryan got more accomplished on Talking Smack as a work shoot than Orton and Lesnar did at SummerSlam in the main event.
I will 100% agree with you.
So
I will 100% agree with you on that, and I will say this.
And proof that The Miz is the only actual honest-to-God heel in that company.
The Miz cut a promo that is probably one of the best Miz promos I've ever seen.
No, it's the best.
Well, it's the best.
No, man, I don't think there's an argument for that.
Yeah. You know, it's unarguably the best promo that The Miz has ever cut, right? It put The Miz in a new light.
Mm-hmm.
It put Daniel Bryan in a different spot. Because now you're looking at, and it was kind of like that new era versus the old guard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at it, this could be Miz. And this is one of the things that the digital dirt sheet was saying. This is one of the things that The Miz was doing. Miz was standing up for the old guard. Look, I've been here 10 years. I've never been injured.
Yeah.
I've never had to take time off for an injury. You know, and then, you know, One of my favorite lines in there that makes me think that this is going in a totally different direction, and I'll tell you somewhere else they did this too. When The Miz looked at Daniel Bryan and said, why don't you go join your indie buddies in the bingo hall?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
there's something there, because I'll tell you another spot they did this on, the Stone Cold podcast, where Dean Ambrose was talking about being on the indies, and Dean Ambrose was talking about this, and then Dean Ambrose, out of his own mouth, said that when he was in Florida Championship Wrestling, he goes, you had to be reminded from time to time that you were working for the WWE, and the only reason you knew this is every now and then you would see logos. He goes, pretty much everybody there felt like they were the bastard child of WWE because they were just this independent territory.
Yeah.
There is so much emphasis right now in the WWE being brought on the indies by bringing up these indie darlings, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
That there's this, there's something, to me, it's like, it's something so obvious going on, and we see that it is, you know, that they are spinning things and they are going in a different direction. But I also think, to tie everything together, there is something else that's going to happen that we're not seeing. And I'm going to tell you right now, I said this off the air to you.
Mm-hmm.
WWE and UFC are in bed together. You can't tell me they're not. There's no way to convince me they're not. There is something going on that we haven't seen yet that I think will lead up to one of the biggest spectacles ever.
All right. First things first, because I know you don't listen to a lot of wrestling podcasts. I do.
Right.
The Ric Flair show this past week had two guests. One was Kurt Angle. Kurt Angle was the very first guest they ever had on the Ric Flair show. So one is Kurt Angle. The second one, which I figured at first when I was watching it, looking at it, I was like, this is a rib. They're going to do a spot with it. No, the second guest was Dana White.
Right.
Now, how the hell the Ric Flair show landed Dana White, I don't know. Dana White talked about the use of Brock Lesnar and CM Punk coming in and basically lending Ronda Rousey to the Fed for WrestleMania the one year. And in his words, during the interview, he had always wanted to work with the WWF and with the WWE with Vince McMahon, but Vince wasn't the easiest guy to work with. And that his interactions with Stephanie and Hunter had been, he thought, very positive, and that Vince was getting a little easier to deal with now that he's kind of the undisputed leader of his field. So, you know, there is that. I think you'll see more interaction between the two. But here's what I think you saw on, here's where I think this is going, ultimately. First things first, I will agree with Jim Cornette from the Jim Cornette Experience. There's a reason that they started using razor blades in the wrestling business. You could have accomplished the same thing if Orton had gigged. It wouldn't have been near as dangerous. Because here's the bottom line. On the surface, yes, it looks badass to have... You cannot, no matter how good you are with a gig, get hit with a working elbow shot and make it look like that shot in that instant busted you open. You're going to have to cut at some point. So there's that. Okay, fine. You don't get quite the same instantaneous effect. We're also in an era of the WWE where concussion is the worst four-letter word in the business, where you have to realize at some point, I don't know if this occurred to anybody when they were booking this, if that spot, that moment had been approved, I don't know if it occurred to somebody of, hey, wait a damn minute. I got the former UFC heavyweight champion of the world sitting on what is arguably one of my most bankable, solid, you know, workers, period, in the company, even now. I've got him sitting on the freaking Golden Boy's chest going to throw an elbow at his head with the point of the elbow hard enough to open a gusher. Didn't occur to anybody that could actually lead to a concussion, that could legitimately put Orton right back on the fucking shelf? Apparently not. It did take 10 stitches to close him up, or not, 10 staples rather. So I think the method to get to where they're going was stupid. I did not think the match was good. There are people, Bruce Pritchard on his show, like I said, I listen to a lot of podcasts, thought it was one of the greatest SummerSlam main events ever. I never did like Brother Love, and now I know why. Because that was dumb. I don't think you delivered. Orton and Lesnar could have done a hell of a match and told a hell of a story with a good amount of time. If you, you know, give them 20 minutes, you're not coming back to it. So give them that time to have a solid match. I don't think it made the first lick of sense to put Brock Lesnar over. I thought it would have made much more sense to put Orton over. And it was the last match on the card. So you sent the crowd home freaking numb. Not booing, not mad, numb. They didn't know what to do.
You know,
so I don't get it. I genuinely don't get it. And by the way, here's where they're going, my opinion. Because here's where they've Ray Charles the hell out of it, in my opinion. You've got freaking you've got Shane McMahon come down, because why not? Because it's his boy. Randy Orton is on his show, getting manhandled. He gets F5'd. At that moment, you can assume it's a work. Now, Raw responds by fining Brock Lesnar $500. You're going to fine the guy that got paid $6 million to appear on UFC and knock a dude out. You're going to fine him $500. Sure, that's probably what he spends for, you know, meals for a day. So you're going to do that, which is obviously the slap in the face kind of tap on the wrist kind of deal, to which you have Shane McMahon respond and put over that something's going to have to be done, blah, 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 blah. And ultimately where it's going to go, I think, is Shane's going to wind up in a match with Brock. Shane's going to get hurt, which gives you a good reason to have two authority figures per show, I guess. Shane's going to get hurt. It's going to prompt Vince to come in. Vince is going to step in to defend his son. And when Vince steps in to defend his son, Vince is going to bring in Goldberg. And Goldberg, that way Goldberg doesn't belong to either brand. That way Goldberg is essentially neutral. You can bring him in for the one shot and let him go. You're going to have a match that's going to be on par with what they did at WrestleMania for all, I think. Well, I think more people will care this go around because they don't know that both people are leaving. But I think that's where it's going. And because they've already segued Orton off.
Yeah. They got Orton going in with Bray Wyatt. So
Orton ain't getting his shit back.
There's, you know, the thing is, there's so many different directions they can go in with this, and so many different things they can do. I think, ultimately, I think it's going to lead to something that everybody can get behind, everybody's going to enjoy, everybody's going to be like, oh, okay. You know, yeah, it was an anticlimactic main event.
Mm-hmm.
It was a moment that, I don't want to say left a bad taste in the mouth, but it is a moment that you look back at and you go, okay, they had something there. They could have done something so much for it. But maybe that's part of the microwave society. Maybe that's part of, okay, we want everything here and now. We want that gratification here and now. And we don't want to say, okay, maybe this match was just a step. And they put a story behind it, like you said, to pop the house. But like I said, you know, time will tell on this. I will go with you and say that it was one of the worst main events. Not marquee-wise. Now, marquee-wise, it's phenomenal.
If you just look at the match on paper, it's tremendous. I even made that remark when I went to go see it. I was talking to Big Willie, Big Willie Isms from Double Stomp Production. I told him, it looks phenomenal. But the bottom line is, you had three main event caliber matches went on before it.
Yeah.
I mean, the world title, the Universal title.
Well, then you also had
title.
Roman Reigns and Rusev.
Yeah,
you said three main event caliber matches before. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, not immediately before it.
Oh, okay.
Well, realistically, you had four. You had four main event level matches on the card. Other than that one, you had the world title, the universal title. You had AJ and Cena, which probably should have actually been the main event, even on the marquee. And then you had the women's title, any one of which could have main evented a pay-per-view.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a damn shame is what it is. Let me ask you this, because you know me. I like a slow roll kind of program. I'm not a microwave kind of society guy. So let me ask you a question. Would you not have achieved the same damn result if Brock Lesnar had just beat Randy Orton's ass for about 9 minutes, give Randy a brief comeback in there somewhere, let the ass-whooping commence again, Orton hits an RKO out of nowhere, rolls him up 1-2-3, and then Orton down selling but celebrating, Heyman brings Lesnar to and Lesnar snaps and then bloodies him.
I don't think so.
I think you have to have Orton lose that match for his program with Bray Wyatt to make sense. Because here's the thing. Bray Wyatt portrays himself as something that transcends everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So if you beat the Beast, right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really have anything to talk about. But now it's like, okay, you didn't beat the Beast, but now I'm going to sit here and mess with you because your time is over, Randy. You know, that kind of shit. So, but I'm going to ask you this real quick. Yes or no?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have such a problem with the finish of the main event because of the finish of the Rusev-Roman Reigns match was exactly the same?
In part. So, I think, but no, my biggest problem with the finish of the main event was it was the main event.
Right. But if you take Roman and Rusev, X that out,
mm-hmm.
right? Just kind of either don't do that finish there or don't have them in the semi-main spot and separate it enough. Do you have less of a problem with the finish of the main?
Yes, I still have a problem with the finish of the main because it's the main fucking event. If you flipped AJ and Cena and the Lesnar-Orton match, if you flip their spots on the card, then the sin is not committed by Orton and Lesnar's match. Then the sin is committed by Rusev and Roman's match.
Okay.
Then the sin falls on the U.S. title for duplicating the fucking finish.
I'm going to put one thought in your head. We'll talk about this next week, too, by the way. We won't talk about the main event.
Obviously,
but I'll put this thought in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Think about this, and you can touch on it real quick if you want. Mike Tyson,
mm-hmm.
in the late 80s, right, used to main event pay-per-views,
mm-hmm.
that would end in 30 seconds.
Yeah, I got pissed then, too.
You would say that Mike Tyson, but here's the thing.
Paid $55 for Tyson Spinks. Yes, I was pissed.
Okay, so, but...
And so was my dad.
But can you agree or disagree to the next statement? Mike Tyson, whenever you put him on pay-per-view, drew money.
No.
Every single time.
I don't think you can disagree with that. But I also think I think you're comparing apples to oranges.
No, we're talking about a main event that ended abruptly and quickly. I mean, I think people actually paid to see that quick knockout with Mike Tyson is what I think they paid to see.
You paid to see Mike Tyson knock the shit out of somebody in 30 seconds.
Right.
You did not pay to see Randy Orton do the job and get left bloody in a shitty match by Brock Lesnar.
I did not go
to watch SummerSlam for that. When I went to watch SummerSlam in regards to the main event, I was expecting, at worst, I was expecting a replay of Orton Cena.
Okay, well, fair enough. But I mean, here's the thing: some people do pay to see that quick knockout. Well, that's come to brings us to the end of our time.
Mm-hmm.
This week on the announcer's booth, I don't know what the hell we're going to talk about next week. I'm pretty sure we can touch on this. We'll touch on managers. We'll touch on a whole lot of shit.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I am at JJ the Body on Twitter. The podcast is at AB Podcast on Twitter.
And don't forget to check out all the great shows on the ECS Network over on YouTube. Denzycaster, Rage Quit Radio, Kana and Mike's Movie Night. Of course, the announcer's booth appears there as well. Don't forget, you can check us out on Twitter. It's at ECSPodcasts, plural, .com. It's on Twitter. But also, don't forget to go buy our merch, the announcer's booth t-shirt and the BDATP 12-3 t-shirt. Along with shirts for all the other great shows and various other merchandise are available at cafepress.com/ECS Network.
Buy the shirt!
Yes.
No, but anyway, I'm John the Body Johnson. He is Greg Hunter. We will see you in 7 days.